All right, welcome back to the Anchor Drop Podcast. I'm Joe, and I'm here with Tim and Steven. Morning, Tim.
Morning.
Morning, Steven.
Good morning.
So that way you guys all know they're actually here in the room with me. I guess that doesn't prove anything. We could be on...
You could have had AI put AI it all together.
Steven is AI, yeah. Steven.
AI, Steven. We're in Genesis 34. This is a heavy one. So we're gonna break it into a few pieces. But before we get started, I'll provide a little... introduction here. Jacob is now in the land. We saw in the last chapter that he settled at Shechem, which was the place that Abraham had previously gone when he first came into the land. But Jacob is on a different footing because he is now he's purchased land. He's settling down in one spot. He's not so much a nomad, but more of a farmer and herdsman in one local place with an eye towards living in this land permanently. This is not, you know, Abraham, he doesn't have the same kind of bounce around and wait, I will give you this land one day. Jacob's got a little piece of it. He's settled in here. And the question that is kind of now, Jacob has 12 sons, and we know that these sons are all going to be heirs in some sense, and that they're part of the nation Israel in the future, unlike Ishmael or Esau. These are actually sons of the promise. But the question is still, who's going to rule? Who's going to be the king over this future nation? Which son is going to get that, that promise, and which son is going to be blessed and receive that inheritance of blessing? Those are the two questions that Jacob and Esau wrestled with. And Jacob got both the blessing of rulership and the promised birthright inheritance. Now, who is going to get those things in among the 12 sons of Jacob? And normally the top choice would start with first son, and unless that son proved to be, you know, disqualifying in some way, then he would receive it possibly, or it would go on down to a son who was more qualified if he disqualified. And that's what we're going to see in this chapter. Some early born sons start to disqualify themselves in some very significant ways. So start at the beginning here. Now, Dinah, the daughter of Leah, whom she had borne to Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and violated her. His soul was strongly attracted to Dinah, the daughter of Jacob, and he loved the young woman and spoke kindly to the young woman. So Shechem spoke to his father Hamor, saying, "Get me this young woman as a wife." And Jacob heard that he had defiled Dinah, his daughter. Now his sons were with his livestock in the field, so Jacob held his peace until they came. Then Hamor, the father of Shechem, went out to Jacob to speak with him. And the sons of Jacob came in from the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved and very angry because he had done a disgraceful thing in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing which ought not to be done.
So the setup here, the thing that we don't know for sure from the language, from the Hebrew, is whether in modern terms this is a rape or a seduction. What we do know is that it should not have happened either way. It was a violation of her dignity either way. And we also know that this particular guy, and we see this through the story, Shechem, the son of Hamor, wants to do the right thing by her, wants to marry her. He is getting things out of order, but he does actually care about her. Which is that's a weird combination of ideas for us to contemplate, but that is what is happening. And so he takes steps to seek to marry her. And we also see Jacob, coming off of the wrestling with God and the dislocated hip. He's not out in the field with his sons like he used to be. He's not as strong as he used to be. So the news comes to him. Instead of going off like a bottle rocket, he holds his peace until his sons come in. He waits. He's gonna get the strong sons together, and then we'll see what we're gonna do.
And with regards to whether this was a rape or seduction, I think one of the things relevant here is that a woman who had been violated, whether it was by force or not, has had her prospects essentially destroyed for the future. And in this culture, in our culture, it's just two consenting adults doing what they want. Nobody's really at fault or anything like that. And a woman can go on and marry somebody else, but that's not really the case here. Like even if this is just, seduction, it is a massive violation and takes away her agency. And this is possibly, even if it was a seduction, the reason for doing it, because now it gives
him massive bargaining power.
It gives him bargaining power to go and marry her, which turns out it takes away her agency and the family's agency, but gives him the opportunity to marry her in a way that he otherwise wouldn't have had the opportunity, because that's her way out of a potentially very horrible future.
Mm-hmm. And we don't love the... This is one of the ways in which the Bible is pragmatic in ways that hit modern sensibilities very crossways. Because we look at this and are immediately like, okay, so marry the rapist is the way out. That sounds like the horrible future that one would try to avoid. Uh-huh. But in a pre-industrial culture where laptop jobs don't exist and you starve if you can't do manual labor, having a husband, having sons is your retirement plan, is how you live, is how you get taken care of when you're sick. No one in this culture survives by themselves, not even the men. But a woman's prospects, and we see this play out with Ruth and Naomi, and like that, a woman's prospects are very, very dire without a husband and children. And this is why we see the one of the frontline solutions is, well, you went this far, now you're going to marry her, because now you have to take care of her for the rest of her life.
That's
you're
right.
Not getting out of it.
That's right. In Exodus, this is just seduction talked about here, but in the context we're talking about, it would be this, it would apply here. If a man entices a virgin who is not betrothed and lies with her, he shall pay the bride price for her to be his wife. If her father utterly refuses to give her to him, he shall pay the money according to the bride price of virgins. So this is what you're saying. You have taken away her prospects, as Joe said, and she is either going to be provided for by you, or she is going to be provided for by you. Like you do not.
Those are the options.
Those are the options. You have done something that can only be done by someone who is willing to spend the rest of their life taking care of this woman, or you will give the money that you would have earned to take care of her for the rest of your life. If you're such a bad guy, we're not going to let you stick around. So there were options to make that violated woman, that disgraced woman, that humiliated woman who lost her prospects, cared for, and God foresaw this. Like, I'm sure it sounds to your comment, Tim, modern sensibilities, this sounds just terrible. And it is. But we have so cheapened the marriage bed that think about it, it's a way better option. Sometimes when people get into the women's rights versus men's rights, they come up with solutions like, well, if you're going to say I can't abort my baby, then you have to pay for this baby the rest of your life. Yes, exactly.
Duh.
That's the rule God set up too.
Did we just reinvent marriage? Is that what happened?
God is so much smarter than we are, even in these hard circumstances where no solution sounds good. Well, God offers a solution that sounds terrible to us, but he is not going to abandon his own. He's got a solution.
Well, and let us not forget, the first solution is don't create these situations.
That's right.
Well, and that's the incentive of the whole social structure and later the laws of Israel or you know, if you seduce and fornicate with a woman or rape a woman, the consequences are significant, you know, for in terms of how that's going to shake out for you for the rest of your life. Yeah. Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah. And therefore, hopefully you don't do it.
Yeah.
That's right.
Still happen, but all right. Picking up in verse 8. But Hamor spoke with them, saying, "The soul of my son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him as a wife and make marriages with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters to yourselves. So you shall dwell with us and the land shall be before you. Dwell and trade in it and acquire possessions for yourselves in it." Then Shechem said to her father and her brothers, "Let me find favor in your eyes, and whatever you say to me, I will give. Ask me ever so much dowry and gift, and I will give according to what you say to me, but give me the young woman as a wife." But the sons of Jacob answered Shechem and Hamor his father and spoke deceitfully, because he had defiled Dinah their sister. And they said to them, "We cannot do this thing, to give our sister to one who is uncircumcised, for that would be a reproach to us. But on this condition, we will consent to you. If you will become as we are, if every male of you is circumcised, then we will give our daughters to you, and we will take your daughters to us, and we will dwell with you, and we will become one people. But if you will not heed us and be circumcised, then we will take our daughter and be gone." And their words pleased Hamor and Shechem, Hamor's son. So the young man did not delay to do the thing, because he delighted in Jacob's daughter. He was more honorable than all the household of his father. And Hamor and Shechem, his son, came to the gate of their city and spoke with the men of their city, saying, "These men are at peace with us. Therefore, let them dwell in the land and trade in it, for indeed the land is large enough for them. Let us take their daughters to us as wives, and let us give them our daughters. Only on this condition will the men consent to dwell with us, to be one people. If every male among us is circumcised and they are circumcised, will not their livestock, their property, and every animal of theirs be ours? Only let us consent to them and they will dwell with us." And all who went out of the gate of this city heeded Hamor and Shechem his son. Every male was circumcised, all who went out of the gate of this of his city.
All right, so I think this is a fascinating look into two things. This story tells us, I think our nation, the church in the United States, is not in a dramatically different spot. It's in a better spot than Israel and his, or Jacob and his sons are. But it's not dramatically different. The question is, how do you dwell with people who don't think the same as you, whose practices are different than yours? You're in a hostile environment. What does it look like to dwell there? And 35 is going to offer a solution there that I think is going to be exciting for us to look at next week, in terms of there's a liturgical aspect of it. And, mm-hmm. but they're dealing with the question now. And so this is an immediate ramification of living with people who don't live by the same rules, and it's painful and it's hard. And that Shechem or, Hamor is the most honorable of the sons of the city, or the father at least, is telling us something. He has just violated Dinah. That is not a very honorable deed. And he's the most honorable among them. So the practice is so widespread that I'm beginning to form this picture of Hamor as, this is what you do when you see a woman you desire. You take her. And
this is what Abimelech was worried about, remember, with Isaac and Rebekah.
What did you bring this beautiful woman in our presence for? It's your fault.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And Hamor's ready to do differently. He's ready to live differently. He's trying to do this honorable thing, it seems, in reaction here. He's more honorable than all the sons of his father, at least, right? So this is an inflection point, perhaps, for the whole city. And they go along with it. They say, yeah, we'll do it. Hamor is either that compelling a person, or the life of this new nomadic tribe who's just moved in and planted among them is so compelling that they're saying, that looks better. Let's go there. Let's give this a shot. It actually is a mass conversion, which is amazing.
Yeah.
And That's a hard thing to, it's a hard thing to say, but sometimes the darkest moments in our lives are going to be useful for the good of the people around us. And that's never, you never, you don't go into a very difficult situation and say, I am so happy this is happening to me because it'll be good to others, but it is something God knows how to do.
And there's a saying in politics, never waste a crisis.
Yeah.
Not usually employed in the most savory of ways, but there's an element of truth to that. God does not waste these things. We shouldn't either.
Right.
It also doesn't help or doesn't hurt any, because as you look at the way that Shechem and his father Hamor make the argument to the city, is look how rich these guys are.
Yeah.
Like, these guys are prosperous. And that's the thing that they kind of front, is so what they're doing is the same thing that we've seen, like that we saw Laban doing. Laban notices everything this guy touches, God blesses. Well, you know, what do I have to pay you to get you to keep taking care of my stuff? Because God blesses you. They're seeing that the fruits of that same blessing and the prosperity that it's bringing. And even for people who are not honorable in the way that Shechem is, that's attractive. It's like there's something there that is good and that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. The fact that they were willing to undergo circumcision here, and you know, like definitely doing it for the money, you know, there and the women, but there's also like I think they know what they're signing up for religion wise, right? Because they're becoming united with this other people, and this is something that's pretty much unprecedented in the rest of the Old Testament. I don't know another time where, other than, you know, an individual becoming, you know, a individual Canaanite getting circumcised here and there, we have that on occasion, or actually, you know, fairly often later on. But here is a whole city of people whose identity is uncircumcised versus the Israelites who are circumcised in the land. This is the dividing line. How do you know who's on Israel's side and who are the wicked Canaanites? And circumcision is the fundamental indicator. And they're willing to disassociate from all the other Canaanites and associate with the God, mm-hmm. Israel and the God of Israel, and become a part of the same people. That's a huge transformation.
It is.
Yeah, it goes without saying in the chapter, but think about the conversation that had to happen here. It's just a minor surgery, boys. What's the problem? right. Well, what is it? What does it mean? Okay. So once upon a time, there was a guy named Abram who lived in Ur, right? Uh-huh. This is the sign of the covenant with Abram.
And yeah. We are in his land.
Yes. This is the land that God has given to him. This is, you know, he said, I will make you a great nation. I will bless you. What you're doing is joining that great nation, mm-hmm. and entering into this relationship with the God of Abraham, becoming part of the nation of Abraham. Like, that's a big, big deal.
Yeah, this is the equivalent of, you know, a missionary going into a village in some tribal country somewhere and preaching the gospel and also saying, we want to, you know, bringing the missionary, bringing his daughters, we want to become one with all of you, you know, just get baptized and get the whole city baptized and you'll worship our God and we can, you know, we can all grow wealthy together. It's like, it's kind of a mixed message, but like they would, if they got baptized, they're actually changing religions.
Yes. We only baptize converts. Sorry about it.
Yeah.
Right.
All right. So this is a huge deal. Let's see how it plays out. 25. Yeah. Now it came to pass on the third day, when they were in pain, the two sons of Jacob, Simeon and Levi, Dinah's brothers, each took his sword and came boldly upon the city and killed all the males. And they killed Hamor and Shechem, his son, with the edge of the sword, and took Dinah from Shechem's house and went out. The sons of Jacob came upon the slain and the plundered of the city because their sister had been defiled. They took their sheep, their oxen, and their donkeys, what was in the city and what was in the field, and all their wealth, and all their little ones and their wives took captive, and they plundered even all that was in the houses. Then Jacob said to Simeon and Levi, "You have troubled me by making me obnoxious among the inhabitants of the land, among the Canaanites and the Perizzites. And since I am few in number, they will gather themselves against me and kill me. I shall be destroyed, my household and I." But they said, "Should he treat our sister like a harlot?" Okay.
Yeah, this is a pretty massive deception and betrayal here. Maybe that's obvious, but going back to the example you gave, if that missionary performed the baptism and then murdered everyone so he could have their stuff, it would not be exactly the Christian way. That's you don't baptize and then murder.
Right.
If you were at war, there's killing. But this is not, you don't say convert to our side and then we'll kill you. This is a deception of a very high order in a very egregious way. This is abusing your religion it's blasphemous. It's pretty ugly. This is pretty high on the list of thou shalt nots. And going back to your disqualification questions, these are two sons of Leah who are proving themselves disinherited. Think of the alternative. It's hard to imagine because it didn't happen, but a whole tribe disassociating from the Canaanites and joining the God of Israel and saying, this is the better way. We kind of think God's right, that this is Abraham's land and we're in it. We'd like to be connected to that, even if their understanding is murky. Can you imagine the implication that has on what Jacob is? And Jacob moves from this stranger to the one who has, hey, what does it mean? What does this circumcision stuff mean? What does this God of Israel look like? Tell us about this. You know, this is a transformation of proportions in the making. And it's, you get the desire for vengeance, right? It's not hard to sympathize that their sister's been treated like a harlot and there should be a price to pay. But this is the exact way to exact vengeance. Is conversion. This is a conversion story or the vengeance story. But you can't do both, and you certainly aren't doing both if your goal is to take their stuff and their women. Like this is, maybe I was wrong about that, but at least they're, they took their wives mm-hmm. captive mm-hmm. and they plunder the houses. This is not a holy war. They would have burned all the stuff and killed all the people if it was a holy war. That's what happens throughout the rest of the Old Testament when it is a holy war of a place doomed to destruction. They didn't do that. This was clearly going beyond vengeance and moving into, you know, and committing
a little bit of war profiteering.
Yes, that's right.
Well, and not the last time we're going to see the sons of Jacob be like, hey, wait, we could make money on this. That's going to come up again.
Yeah. Yeah, and the other story that is analogous, I think, to this in the Old Testament is the Gibeonites. When mm-hmm. the conquest is happening, the Joshua makes the Gibeonites deceive Joshua and the people of Israel and say they're from a far country, and they make a covenant together. I don't think circumcision was involved there, but they make a covenant to both live in the land and defend each other. And God disapproved of them making that covenant with him, but he held them to the covenant. Mm-hmm. And throughout the history of Israel, the Gibeonites were treated as sub citizens, but still part of the land. They had requirements and obligations to take care of the Gibeonites, even if they were the water carriers and the, you know, servants of the household of God at some level. They were also in covenant with Israel, and God held them to that. And this is this is the way these people should have been treated, as now members of the covenant at some level.
And part of you see this in, I think the resolution to the Gibeonite story is downstream from this. That's like Joshua, right, and the rulers of Israel, like, realize that they've been had. And it's like, well, we can't kill them.
Right.
That's what got two of these tribes disinherited. That's off the table. Uh-huh. What do we do now? But also you see in Jacob's reaction, like, there's what they've just done, understandable as it is, just makes life impossible. Mm-hmm. Jacob's a nomad. This is the land he's supposed to be in. He bought land here. He's planning to settle here for the rest of his life. But nomads and sedentary societies always have difficult relationships. And he just, like, there's no agreement he can make now with anybody ever, mm-hmm, that anyone will believe. Like, if your sons will violate this, then there's nothing they won't do.
Yeah.
There's no, like, he can't make a peace treaty with anybody now. He is too dangerous to have as a neighbor. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he might be a good guy. That's fine. Jacob's fine. But his sons, yikes. You can't afford to have that next door. It doesn't matter how rich they are. Mm-hmm. And so, like, his objections here are pragmatic, but they're really substantial. Everybody else is going to see this and band together because we're too dangerous to have around, and they're going to kill us all. And that he's right to be afraid of that.
His sons are clearly following in some aspect of his temperament. They're men of action, as Jacob has proven to be, but they did not wrestle with God first. They wanted the vengeance in their own way. And they kind of used God as a decoy to make it easier for them to get their way, which is, mm-hmm, about as ugly as it gets in abuse of the faith.
And they don't have an answer when he says, look, here's the problem now. Their answer is not like, oh, we thought of that. Here's a strategy.
Right.
Right. It's like, you can't treat our sister like that. Like, they have not thought beyond the end of their noses. They had a,
right,
like, they're mad about it. They're going to do something, and then we'll sort it out on the back end. Yeah.
All right. Well, that brings us to the conclusion of chapter 34. And
real quick, I think it's good for us to just peg in the minds of everyone who just read this. Chapter 35 follows 34, and we're going to come back to what do you do in the case of defilement. And there's going to be some ritual aspects of 35 that show us a appropriate response to that. So just note to hold on to. There's the sanctification of defilement.
Yes.
Yep. All right, and we'll close it out today with just checking in on what you guys have been reading or studying or listening to. Since the last time we talked about that, anybody have something they want to kick it off with?
Sure. I read a fat book that I'm not particularly recommending, but this is one I've been reading. It's called The Biodynamic Heart. It's by Michael Shea. He's a hands-on, you know, started out as a craniosacral therapist and has gone in all kinds of directions, but deals mostly with cardiovascular issues at this point, but it's hands-on healing. Really interesting character. I've been paying attention to his work for a while. Not particularly a Christian, but very, very conscious of the fact that you can't heal apart from dealing with the spiritual aspects of, like, the spiritual aspects of a person are involved in what you're doing, and the community relationships are involved in what you're doing, and has a fascinating treatment of, he did a 10-year apprenticeship with a Navajo medicine man, working, learning how to help people heal in community, and says some really interesting things around, like, the healing ceremonials that are in the Navajo culture and the way in which they deal with illness or with psychological damage by bringing someone back into the culture and literally retelling the creation story to them. Like, this is your story. And then bringing different people to them to invite them back into the culture. It's a fascinating it's a fascinating discussion, and it's an interesting look at how people who don't know God and don't have some of the things that we have, nonetheless live in God's world and working in the creation, discover we really, you know, it turns out to be relevant. How the world was created turns out to be relevant when you're trying to heal. Mm-hmm. How that we're built turns out to be relevant. The fact that we're spiritual beings and in relationship with one another turns out to be relevant. You can't mm-hmm. really do this kind of work without that.
Nice. I'm reading Everyone Belongs to God, which is a collection of letters from Christoph Blumhardt to his son-in-law, who was a missionary. So Blumhardt was a kind of turn-of-the-century German pastor turned politician and turned kind of mission-minded person, whose son-in-law then went into the mission field. And so while he was in the mission field, Blumhardt wrote these letters to his son-in-law about how to think about what God is doing in the world. And one of the key things he brought to it is to, like, your job is to not make converts, but to bring the kingdom of God to life among these people. And was very unsatisfied, you might say, with the missionary approach of going into a place and just and only doing the conversion thing. He wanted to go much, much further than that. And with an eye towards everybody already has an experience and an encounter with God. And we're not just going in and bringing them, starting from scratch. God's already been working here. So there's a mentality that's much more holistic from kind of the historical missionary movement at this point, and trying to bring about a full orbed redemption of a place, not simply conversion of a few people and being satisfied with that. And also not being satisfied with some of the missionary work that was going on at this point was sort of a colonial project that was both conversion plus making the place, in this case, making the place more German. And that's actually the missionaries were partly employed by the government. And so that was part of their job he was over on an island near China. So it was a Chinese territory that Germany now owned. And he was partly employed by his son-in-law was partly employed by the government to bring German culture and ideals to China as well. And Blumhardt had a different idea for that, but I don't know that I agree with everything about his approach, but it's kind of a widening approach to think about how we're supposed to do our work in this world. It's not just conversion. It's also bringing about the kingdom of God in all of its fullness.
Love it. Well, amen. My readings are plotting readings. So I am still in Brothers Karamazov and The Lord of the Rings, and
you haven't finished those since last week.
Shocking. Yeah. With the summer playtime, our reading time has started a little later than normal, so we're not getting through a chapter a night either. So it's probably going to be the story on for a while of the two main books I'm reading. Though both of these are encouraging, maybe I can pick up. Joe's book is not quite as thick as Tim's. Maybe I can pick up a small one and nick away at another one. And then on the readings, I've stuck with. The podcast, I've stuck with a few that I go to regularly, and James Jordan is still high on that list. So, you know, we've recommended that name a few times, and I will continue to do so. It has been. It opens your eyes on how to read the scriptures for sure.
All right. Thank you, Tim and Stephen, and we'll see you on Sunday, church.